This is Tony May. I manage KMMK with my wife, Sue. This is a recording of the KMMK Fall Banquet on October 23rd, 2021, featuring EWTN's beloved Father Joseph Mary Wolfe and Relevant Radio best-selling author and host of the 9 a.m. Patrick Madrid Show.
Just a few months ago, I was up at the shrine, and here was a mother with her little girl, and they had an older boy, but they really wanted to have a little girl, so they brought pink balloons and brought them to Mother's tomb that she would pray for a little girl. And here was little Trinity Angelica. But the more amazing part of that story, and there are many stories of how mother and the sister would pray for infertile couples who would have children. I met this man down in Irondale when the sisters were still there, and he was there, and his little boy Ignatius was there, and I said, well, hello, and he said, yeah, we came here years ago, we were childless, and now we have five children, so we came to ask the sisters to stop praying. But the story I heard a few months ago was this mother with a little girl, and she said, my cousin came here in 2006, so Mother Angelica was still with us. She died in 2016, Easter Sunday. But she was debilitated from this major cerebral hemorrhage that she had. And so she would occasionally meet with people in the parlor, even when she wasn't really able to talk. And so this couple had gone. They said, Mother, we don't have any children. Would you please pray for us? And Mother couldn't really talk, so she goes, and the mother or the woman responds, well, Mother, we just really want one child. That's all we're really praying for. And she said, a year later, on Mother Angelica's birthday, they had twins. A boy and a girl. So Mother's cause is progressing. Michael Warsaw has met with the bishop a couple of times and the sisters. And we've been collecting testimonials that we've gotten over these last 5 years. And now that 5 years has passed, we can more formally pursue that. But tonight I wanted to talk about, in Irondale, we have an AM radio station, WMMA, Mother Mary Angelica. So it's named after Mother Angelica. And here you have KMMK, so same two middle letters, MM. Well, on WMMA in Irondale, I know a man who is now a deacon, and he just happened to come across the radio station, and he was not Catholic. He had gone to different denominations, and he's kind of searching, and he comes across Catholic radio. He begins to listen. He gets answers to his questions. Eventually comes into the church, is eventually ordained to the diaconate. And when I talk to him, I see him regularly. When he starts to talk about the Eucharist, he begins to tear up. Because for years, he had been without the consolation of that sacrament. And now that he has it, and now he serves at the altar, he's a daily communicant, it's like the joy of his life. It's like he's found what he was looking for. And that's what we're about. And then you think about those call letters, WMMA, KMMK, and one of those M stands for Mary. Mother Mary Angelica, Maximilian Mary Colby. And so I'm happy that Tony talked about consecration to Our Lady. If you make that consecration to Our Lady, if you've never done it, look out. She's going to take you at your word, and she's going to put you into action to bear fruit, to extend the kingdom of the Sacred Heart of her Son, Jesus. And so the sisters take as part of their name Mary. So do the friars. Some would say, well, that's kind of unusual. Well, Not really in the history of the saints, if you think about Maximilian Mary Kolbe, John Marie Vianney, Louis Marie de Montfort, Anthony Mary Claret. There are many saints who took Our Lady as part of their name, as we do, because we annually make a consecration to Mary. In fact, approaching December 8th, we always make Maximilian Kolbe's novena, his 9-day novena before December 8th. So, and then you think about Mother Angelica. EWTN was founded on December 12th. It became an entity December 12th, 1980, Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe, whom Pope St. John Paul II called the star of the new evangelization. It launched 40 years ago, August 15th, Feast of Our Lady's Assumption. And so I think that Maximilian Kolbe and Mother Angelica were zealous about the Church's mission. So today is World Mission Sunday, as I mentioned. And to think of those two people, Mother Angelica, Maximilian Kolbe, and the zeal they had to spread the gospel. And it was said of Maximilian Kolbe, he would go 10 times to the chapel. Well, you can imagine, he had like 600 friars or more at Napokalanov, at Marytown. He needed a lot of help, you know, to manage Napokalanov and all of those friars. But he also had this apostolic zeal that he wanted to go to Japan. Well, where would he go before he'd go to Japan? He went to Lourdes. He went there first to pray, to ask for Our Lady's help in this new mission going to Japan. And what would he carry in his pocket? Something he called the silver bullet. Miraculous medals. I was talking earlier about Mother Teresa with a lady here who sat on her lap as a little girl. And Mother Teresa would always give out these miraculous medals. So there's a connection there with the Eucharist and Our Lady. And so Sue and Tony and Tom, that whenever you're coming up and you're trying to make a decision, you're trying to know which way we're supposed to go, or whenever you feel burdened or kind of overwhelmed by the mission, you know, there are times Mother Angelica just ran into the chapel practically with her braces and all of that and just goes before the Lord in his Eucharistic presence. And he would give her light. He'd give her strength. He would show her the next step that she was to take, to go forward in faith. And so that's the formula for all of us. As I mentioned at Mass, the Eucharist is the heart of everything we do. And I really believe it's part of God's providence that he chooses a nun who's devoted to adoration of the Blessed Sacrament. I was talking with Patrick earlier that suppose we had all gotten together back in 1981 when the network began, and we said, okay, we need to start a network, a Catholic network that's going to reach the whole world. All right, well, first we need somebody in charge that knows television through and through. They've been involved in it. Number two, we need to have a large bank account because TV is expensive. Third, build it in a strong Catholic area, like maybe the Archdiocese of Dubuque. So what does God do? He says, I'll choose someone who's never even turned on a television set. She's got $200, and she lives in an area 2% Catholic. I'll choose her. Because then it becomes obvious that it's his work. It's he who is accomplishing it. One time, there was a bishop from Mexico who had come, and the sisters were still living in Irondale at that time, and Mother was giving him a personal tour of the network. And after they finished the tour, the bishop said to Mother, Mother, there is no way you could have done this without divine help. And Mother said, that's what I've been trying to tell people, you know. that he's the one that inspired it, and he's the one that's provided for it, and he's the one that keeps it going. And I think one of the miracles of EWTN is that it's been on the air 40 years. And it's all viewer supported. And I mean, we have a pretty big payroll. We have 11 TV channels. We have 8 radio channels. We have over 400 employees, probably close to 500 worldwide. Satellite time, all of that stuff. And yet, Mother always believed that as long as we were faithful and striving to do what God wanted, that he would provide for it. And he has. And so I think that's one of the miracles of EWTN, is that it's continued to go and to grow. You know, when Mother, toward the end of her life, she spent the last 8 years of her life in bed. And it was during that time you saw this beautiful flowering in her soul. I knew her since 1985, you know, until she died. I was there at her deathbed. But you saw something beautiful that happened those last years of her life, that she was called out of the cloister to do something people thought was ridiculous. I was an engineer at that time when EWTN celebrated its 5th anniversary. And so Mother was on the live show and she said, "Yeah, I heard the naysayers. They said, I'll give them 6 months. They'll never make it." Well, to all of you who said such things, ha, ha. They made it to the 5th anniversary. But what you saw at the end of Mother's life, the 8 years she spent in bed, people wanted to just be with her. And there were many doctors and nurses, retired nurses, that they just volunteered to be with her through the night, help her out. Because there was something going on in that room. There was something powerful going on. God had called her out of that cloistered prayer life. Start this mission, now it's undergoing, and then she's called back. And what you saw was the network grew more than it ever had in its history during that time of prayer, suffering, offering. And something was beautiful happening in her soul. And so there were people that just wanted to see her. And so toward the end of her life, I mentioned this to Patrick earlier, that we had, after Mother had died, the doctors and nurses that had helped take care of her, they said, "We want to see the places where Mother Angelica lived in Canton, Ohio. So we want you to come with us." So I traveled with them. We visited her home, or the area where she lived, and the Timken roller bearing factory where she worked, and it's still in existence, and the monastery where she got that call to go to the south, and all those places. And one of the nurses said, "You know, this is something interesting, that Mother has this major cerebral hemorrhage on Christmas Eve." And Mother had said that she wanted to go to heaven. She wanted the child Jesus to say, "Come on, let's go." That was how she described going to heaven. So here it is, Christmas Eve. She has this major cerebral hemorrhage. We rush to the hospital in Coleman. And Dr. Hall said, "Well, my mother just died of this a month ago. So he's preparing us. Mother's not going to make it." But they rushed her down to the hospital in Birmingham. And providentially, the brain surgeon was the very man, surgeon who had been on our live show years before. And he said, "When I was on that live show, Mother asked me if I'd ever seen a miracle during a surgery." And I said, "Well, not during a surgery, but after a surgery. I've seen people recover." Well, Mother made a miraculous recovery, really, and did further work. But then, those last years she spent on the cross, really, with Christ, offering, praying, seeing people. If she didn't really want to see them, she just closed her eyes and pretend she's asleep. But most of the time, she would take your hand, and she'd give you a little wink, squeeze your hand. One time, one of the sisters said, "Mother likes chocolate milk. You want some chocolate milk?" "Sure." And she's making she's slurping the bottom of the cup, and she's kind of making a little fun and a wink and all of that. But then on Good Friday, she has terrible pain. Holy Saturday was more peaceful, and then Easter Sunday, she goes. So it's interesting that this whole saga began with the incarnation, Christmas Eve, and then it concludes on Easter Sunday. But I think these things point to the reality of our faith, that we live in a media-defined culture, and God is never outdone by what the world's up to. He wants saints in this time in history. And hopefully you all want to be saints. We all want to be saints. We don't deny that that's our goal. That's what we want to be. And as I mentioned at Mass, what does God have for you to do? We can throw up our hands and say, it's hopeless, it's useless. There's nothing really that we can do. The world's lost. I'm just going to kind of hovel in a corner and just try to eke it out. Or we can go before the Lord and say, Lord, I know you, I love you, I want to know you more. What do you want me to do? And if we affect one person, that's an eternal consequence for that person. The Lord wants you to be a saint in 2021, in a media-defined culture, to make a difference here now, at least in someone's life, hopefully more people's lives. And if you are faithful to the Lord, there is going to be a fruitfulness. There is going to be many souls that are going to be touched, often in quiet, hidden ways where we're just practicing charity in our day-to-day life, living out our faith. So I've gone on long enough, so thank you for your support of the network and the radio apostolate. Keep going. When God's at work and when Our Lady's interceding, look out, because things are going to happen. And the Lord's going to call you to be part of that, and to put whatever talents, experiences, and knowledge that you have, strength that you have, to put it toward the spreading of the gospel. And it will make a difference. God bless you.
All the way from Worthington, Iowa.
How about a nice, warm Cedar Rapids, Iowa welcome to Pastor Smithers.
Thank you so much. And yes, Cyrus sends his greetings. He couldn't be here tonight, so he sent me instead. I'm very happy to be here. Tom, it is not fun to come after such a great speaker as Father. It kind of reminds me of as if the Rolling Stones had just finished their concert, and here comes the accordion player. You know, that's me. That's what I feel like right now. But in the time allotted, I'd like to share on a topic of interest to me because of the work I've been doing now for the better part of about 35 years, the work of helping people come into or back into the Catholic Church. Some of you, of course, many of you perhaps know me from my radio program. Some of you may know the work that I did starting many years ago in writing books, and the first of my books was called Surprised by Truth. And that book came out 27 years ago now. It's hard to imagine it's been that long. But that was a book of conversion testimonies because I was at the time working at Catholic Answers, and I had become a real avid student of the process of conversion. Now, I myself am not a convert, unlike Scott Hahn and Marcus Grody and Tim Staples and so many of the other household Catholic figures that you are familiar with. I guess I was one of the token cradle Catholics, and so I come at this issue from that standpoint. I'd never had to sacrifice or suffer for my Catholic faith, and chances are that's probably true for most all of you. I'm assuming most of you are probably, like I am, a cradle Catholic. And to those of you who are converts, you know from the other side of the picture what you may have had to go through and even give up to become a Catholic, that pearl of great price. So over the years that I've had a chance to study the dynamics of conversion, I've learned a few things about what works and what doesn't work, largely through my own failures, and I'll share with you a few of those items tonight. But I've discovered from the great saints, but also from my own failures, that if you follow certain techniques, you can be very effective at helping people come back to the Catholic Church. In fact, many of the people that you might be thinking of right now, and perhaps you're thinking, well, that person would never, ever become Catholic. Well, these miracles do happen, as Father was referring to, miracles that take place all the time. And one little, not a miracle, but I should mention, Father, in light of your comments, is that although I got my start working at Catholic Answers, I very early on was invited to be on EWTN. So my first appearance on EWTN was in 1990. I was only 7 years old, but it was a very it was very instructive for me. And over the course of the years, I had a number of television series that I would do. Typically, the way a series would be, I have a series on this topic, search and rescue. The way a series is you go down to the network and you spend the better part of a week and you film all day long, every day for about 3 or 4 days at a stretch, all the episodes in a series. And I bring enough different neckties with me so that I don't look exactly the same from one episode to the other, but usually they're filmed back to back. And then at the end of that time, you have 16 episodes in a series. So over the course of time that I was visiting EWTN on a regular basis, I had a number of opportunities to meet Mother Angelica. She had me on her program, the live program, once, and it was not too long before she began to have her health problems. But one story that ties in with EWTN that I'd like to share you briefly, it has to do with a woman that worked for me when I was publishing Envoy magazine. And that was a bi-monthly journal of Catholic apologetics, and it ran for about 15, 16 years, and then we ran out of our institutional funding. And that's the way things happen. Things don't last forever. But there was this lovely woman named Caroline who worked as one of our editors. And she was married. She had 6 children. She was late 30s when I first met her. Wonderful lady, always laughing, always smiling, very joyful. And I was shocked when, years later, she called me one evening to tell me that she had cancer. And what had happened was she was out for a bike ride one day, and the bike took a tumble, and she bruised her side. She thought it was maybe a cracked rib or something like that. The doctors didn't find anything. But after a few weeks of continued pain and eventually getting a little short of breath, they began to look more closely at what it was, and eventually, it took a long time, in fact it took too long, before they finally diagnosed that she had lung cancer. And she had never smoked a cigarette in her life. And I kept telling myself, I'm going to go visit her, I'm going to go visit her. And I would always have one excuse or another. I was always too busy, or I was traveling, or what have you. And I put it off and put it off and put it off until eventually I got the word that Caroline had died. And at that point, I felt extremely remorseful because she was a good friend and she had helped me quite a bit in the work of the magazine. And through my own procrastination, my own laziness, I had no one to blame but myself, I really took it hard. And it was very difficult for me in the weeks and months after Caroline's death, compared to her family, her children, her husband. I'm sure my grief was nothing by comparison. But for me, it was a lot. And I really felt remorseful that I had not taken the time to go visit her at least once. And so I was living with this sense of self-reproach. It just so happened that I was visiting EWTN, and I was there to film something. I don't remember now what. And there's a little dining room where the people who are going to be on the TV programs, the guests, will eat and take their meals. And so one day at lunch, I was eating my lunch, minding my own business. And I think I was talking to maybe Father Mitch Pacwa or somebody who was there with me, we were talking. And then when lunch was over, a lady who was seated a couple of tables away from me, she was seated with another woman. She came over to me and she said, "Excuse me, you're Patrick Madrid?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "Do you mind if I talk to you for a minute?" I said, "Sure." So we stepped outside into the courtyard. And she said, "Well, my apostolate is that I take people to Lourdes, people who are dying. And it just so happens that one lady that I took to Lourdes was named Caroline." And she proceeded to tell me that when Caroline was at Lourdes with her husband, that she was talking about me. Now, why would she be talking about me? I don't know. She could be talking about her children, talking about all kinds of other things. But the lady told me, she said that your friendship with Caroline meant a lot to her. And as she was dying, so she was probably at that time, maybe within a month or so of her death. And she said she really was very joyful, and she was talking about how much she enjoyed working with you and how she liked doing the job of the magazine. Now, you might expect that this would make me feel worse than I already did, but it made me feel so much better. It was very liberating. I took it as kind of a miracle. It was a Lord's miracle that did not involve Caroline's healing. It involved my healing. Because what's the likelihood? What are the odds that I would just happen to sit at a lunch room, in a lunchroom, a couple tables over from somebody who just happened to have taken Caroline and her husband to Lourdes, and she just happened to talk about me? And so what happened in my case was I had a healing. That's the only way I can really describe it. And all of my remorse and all of my self-reproach, you know, why didn't I visit Caroline, it all went away. And in that moment, I had the distinct impression that Caroline, perhaps in heaven, was saying to me, "It's okay. It's okay. It's all good, and I'm not mad." And from that day forward, I've just been very, very happy about this. And all those feelings sort of left me. Well, the reason I'm telling you this story is, in part, because it involves being at EWTN, where this little miracle took place, but also because I don't live a life where I'm expecting miracles. I don't live a life, and chances are you don't either, where you're anticipating amazing miracles to take place from one day to the next. I don't think too many people live that way. But it taught me a lesson, and that is that there are all kinds of miracles that are waiting to happen if we're willing to be instruments for God to make use of us. Just like that lady who took Caroline to Lourdes. She was an instrument. And since then, and even before then, but especially since then, it has made a deep impression upon me about how your efforts to help your family and friends come back to the Catholic Church can be supercharged with miracles if you know how to look for them and if you know how to prepare for them. So I'd like to share with you a few things on that particular theme that you may find helpful. I'm also going to try to give you a few techniques that you can use. So if you're listening to me on my program in the future, you may even hear me use some of these techniques when I'm talking to an angry caller, for example. I hear that comment a lot. People say, "Oh, how you handle those angry callers or the people who are so mean to you." Well, part of it is practice, but a lot of it is I realize that if I were to show my true feelings of irritation, that I would lose audience sympathy. And I would also very likely lose the other person's paying attention to what I'm trying to say. So that was one of the first big lessons for me as I was learning how to share the faith, is to, whenever possible, to avoid polemics, to avoid arguments. Now, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't use arguments in a philosophical sense. We all have to use arguments. We have to state our reasons for why we believe what we believe, but not do it in an argumentative way, I guess would be the best way I could put it. To do it in a way that is charitable and respectful, patient. I like it when people are patient with me, so I feel I need to be patient with other people. And to not see them as a potential victory, but rather as somebody whom Jesus died for, whom Jesus loves. And he has given you and he's given me these opportunities to be of service to that person along the way. And sometimes in the most unexpected of ways, these things happen. Now, I'll tell you one or two anecdotes, and If I've told them on the air before and you've heard them, please forgive me for visiting them again, but I think some of them are extremely instructive for me. One example was when I was working at Catholic Answers in San Diego, and I got a call one day from a Mormon fellow in Los Angeles who said, "Hey, you'll never guess who came to speak at our Mormon church this past weekend. He knows you. You know him." I said, "Who?" And he said, "Isaiah Bennett." And I said, "Isaiah Bennett? The only Isaiah Bennett I know is in Brooklyn, New York. He's a Catholic priest. He's a parish priest. He's a pastor. And he's the only Isaiah Bennett I know. And the reason I knew him was because he had invited me to come out around 1990 and do a weekend seminar at his parish about Mormonism and Jehovah's Witnesses, because a lot of his Catholic folk were being siphoned off into these groups. So he wanted somebody to come and kind of inoculate his parishioners." And I did, and I got to know him a little bit. We had a nice dinner on Saturday night, and that was sort of the end of it. But during that time, he told me how much he was interested in apologetics with Mormons. And so he was doing a lot of reading and a lot of studying. Well, lo and behold, what I found out, much to my shock, was that since my visit, he became a Mormon. So the Mormon guy in Los Angeles is gleeful, and he's telling me, yeah, he's not even a priest anymore. He left the Catholic Church. He left the priesthood. He was like their Scott Hahn. And so he was going around the country giving talks about Mormonism and why you should become a Mormon. And here's this Catholic priest. So I felt so terrible. And I also knew instantly that that would never go on my resume, that I had visited that parish. I mean, just think how bad that is. You know, I go to the parish to help the parish with Mormonism, and the priest becomes a Mormon. That doesn't look very good. So he said, "Here's his phone number. He's living up near Salt Lake City now, and he'd like to talk to you." And I took the number down, but I was so heartbroken about the whole thing. I couldn't believe it. And it was near the end of the day, and my phone kept ringing in my office. And since I didn't want to talk to anybody, I kept letting it go to voicemail. And I went home. Following day, I told Nancy about it, and she couldn't believe it. So the following day, I take out the piece of paper with Isaiah's phone number on it. And I thought, well, I might as well get this over with. So I dial the number, call him up. I recognize his voice. And I said, "Hi, Isaiah, this is Patrick Madrid." And he paused for seemed like a minute. It was probably 10 seconds. And he said, finally, he said, "Well, you weren't supposed to call me." And I said, "What?" I said, "The guy in L.A., he said that he wanted me to call you, and he gave me your number." He said, "Yes, but I changed my mind because I didn't want to have a conflict with you. I didn't want to get into an argument with you because we had had such a nice, you know, dinner and the time when you came to my parish a few years ago." So he had called the Mormon guy and told the Mormon guy to tell me not to call Isaiah Bennett. But because I was feeling so bad, I never picked up the phone. So when I got in on Monday, there were like 10 messages from this guy frantically telling me, "Don't call Isaiah Bennett." So I said, "Well, gee, I'm really sorry. I didn't know that. But if you don't want to talk to me, I'll understand." He says, "Well, you know, as long as we're on the phone, what the heck?" So we had a long and tedious conversation. And it was tedious for me because, you know, I'm something of an expert, if there is such a thing, in Mormonism. It's an area that I've devoted a lot of time and study to. So I'm knowledgeable enough that I would think I had some recourse to appeal to him. But nothing I said had the slightest effect. I told Nancy, I said, it was like throwing ping pong balls at a tank. You know, it didn't stop him at all. And by the end of the conversation, I felt even worse than I did at the beginning, because I realized that nothing I said had any effect on him. And so I was really depressed. And I thought, well, I'm just going to put this out of my mind because there's nothing else to do. So about 6 months go by. And on a Saturday, Isaiah Bennett calls me. And I'm thinking, okay, he wants round two, because he's going to come after me. So he's thinking, probably the Mormons are thinking, okay, we got Isaiah Bennett, then we're going to get Patrick Madrid, then we're going to get Scott Hahn, then we're going to get, you know. So I said, "Yeah, what's up?" He said, "Well, you might want to sit down." I said, "Okay." He said, "I want you to be the first one to know that I've come back to the Catholic Church." And I said, "Oh, wait, thank you. Hold your applause. Give them to God, not me." But I said, "I'm glad I'm sitting down, because I probably would have collapsed. What happened?" And he said, "Well," he said, "when you called me 6 months ago," he said, "do you remember the question that you asked me?" I said, "No, I asked you 20 questions. In fact, I thought everything fell flat." He said, well, no. He said, one question that you asked me really shook me. And I didn't even remember when he told me the question. I still don't remember asking him the question, but I know I must have. And the question was, Isaiah, you're a Catholic priest. How could you turn your back on Christ in the Eucharist? And he said that he tried to feign bravado, but it really irked him. It not only kind of shook him, but also made him angry. Like, you know, I don't believe in that stuff anymore. I don't believe in the Mass or the Eucharist. I'm a Mormon now. And he said that when he put the phone down at the end of our conversation, his hands were shaking. And I had no knowledge of this. So this just haunted him for months. And he said there were a variety of other things that happened. It was sort of maybe instigated by that conversation. But then other things started happening. And the way he described it was, at a certain point, it was as if the fog had just cleared. And suddenly he came face to face with the horror of what he had done, this public apostasy, and being so blind to it. And so he made a good, heartfelt confession. He reconciled with the church. He was not allowed to resume public ministry, obviously because of the public nature of the apostasy. But he became a devout, daily communicant, living a life of quiet obscurity. I think he became a postman, for all I know. And I've lost track of him. I don't even know if he's still alive yet. But that was, to my mind, a miracle. Because, and I liken it unto a Eucharistic miracle. Because it was as if, the more I thought about it and prayed about it, it was as if our Lord in the tabernacle reached out through the man in Los Angeles to me, and reached out through me to the former priest living up in Salt Lake City to tap him on the shoulder and say, come home. And he did. And it was because of the Eucharist. And the lesson I learned was that I was just a pencil, a crayon. I was a piece of charcoal, whatever, that God wrote this message to this man. I had really nothing to do with it, except that the Lord used this chance comment that I made that I didn't even remember making. And it was so powerful in this man's life that he had a profound reconversion and he came home. Now, if you can picture what it must have been like for him going around the country giving talks about how great it is to be Mormon, a former Catholic priest, you probably, nobody would blame you for thinking, well, there's somebody who would never come back to the Catholic Church. And he did. And he did under what I regard to be, modestly at least, miraculous circumstances. I don't know how else to account for it. I think it was probably my guardian angel that was restraining me from answering the phone in my office, because if I had answered the phone, I would have been told, don't call Isaiah Bennett, and I never would have called him. And he probably would still be a Mormon today. So don't ever fear, as I think all of us do at one time or another, that you don't have the right words. Or don't ever fear that, well, I don't know theology, or I don't have Bible verses memorized. Scott Hahn can do that, but I can't do that. Don't ever feel that way. Because even in the midst of maybe what you think of as a throwaway comment, that could be the very issue that will help somebody. And I've seen it happen countless times. People who are willing, even if they're not able to speak so much because they don't feel comfortable with it, you can give away a book. You can give away a CD. I don't know if people have CD players anymore, but you used to be able to give away CDs. Now you can send a digital download link. You can have people listen to Catholic radio. Encourage people to listen to the programming. I say that all the time on the show. You know, when I talk to parents whose children have grown up and left the church, I say routinely, well, why don't you let me help them? Well, how do I do that? Text them the link to my show, relevantradio.com/Patrick. Or text them the link to KMMK and just say, hey, there's some really good stuff on the radio. And even if you do nothing else, even just doing that could actually be a miracle waiting to happen, because all of the young people and a lot of the older people like us are all glued to their phones anyway, aren't they? So if you try it, I mean, what have you got to lose? Text a link to, let's say, my show, if you'd like to do that. And don't be surprised if down the road one of your sons or daughters who has left the church says, you know, I didn't know what to make of it at first, but I started listening and I come back to the church. I love telling the story of two parents who came up to me at an event at a parish one day. This is some years ago. And they told me right up front, they said, we raised our son strong in the Catholic faith. He was an altar boy. He received all the sacraments. and he started getting into heavy metal rock music, and his personality changed, and he started wearing black, and he was, you know, just really going down a very dark path. And he stopped going to Mass, and we've been beside ourselves. We don't know what to do. Now, I thought that was the end of their comment. I thought they were going to ask me, what can I do? But they gave me the happy ending. They said that he moved out of the house, and he got a job where he had to move across the city, where he closer to his other job. And one day when he came home to visit them, about a year later, he went to Mass with them on Sunday. And so, of course, they're shocked and happy, and they said, you're going to Mass again? And he said, yeah, I started going to Mass a few months ago. And they said, well, what happened? And he said, well, when I got my job transfer, the heavy metal music station I used to listen on the radio to with all these dark satanic songs, he said, when I started working at the other location, I couldn't tune it in. I kept tripping over this Catholic radio station, and I didn't want to hear that. But after a while, I heard something that sounded a little bit interesting. So long story short, the parents gave me the happy ending, which was they prayed and they prayed and they prayed, and they felt they were getting nowhere with him, and they felt as though he was just going down a black hole, when in fact, not only did he rediscover his Catholic faith, but he discovered a vocation to the priesthood. And they were so overjoyed to tell me that their son was in the seminary now studying for the priesthood. So there again, a miracle, I think. And it had to do with the parents, their fidelity, their prayers for him, not giving up on him. Now, they didn't necessarily do anything directly, but they were there praying for him in the background, and he attributed his eventual reconversion to his parents' prayers. You know, St. Monica, for example. Or another example in which I think I may have shared this on the radio in recent months, but there was a young woman who called a program, and this was, say, within the last, she probably called within the last 6 months or so, and she was kind of emotional at first, and she said, I really want to just thank you for your program, and I just have learned a lot. And she said, my story is that after I got out of high school and I moved out of the house, I was really just checked out from the faith. My parents raised me Catholic, and I was just checked out. I was having too much fun. And she didn't get into any details, but she said she was living a kind of promiscuous party lifestyle and never went to Mass, never prayed. It was just checked out. And she told me that her older brother had been bugging her and just saying, hey, you got to listen to this radio program in the morning. And she was like, yeah, whatever. She wasn't interested. And he kept telling her this, and she didn't do anything until one day she happened to tune in. And I was talking about a book that I talk about from time to time called The Dogma of Hell. Now, the backstory, you have to understand the backstory of this, and then we'll come back to this young woman. So years ago, when one of my siblings, one of my sisters, I'm the oldest of eight kids, so this is one of my younger sisters, she was kind of going down a similar path. She hadn't left the church, but she was sort of becoming very worldly. She wanted to be like the next Madonna, that kind of thing. And so she was kind of starting to live like Madonna, and I was alarmed. And so I wanted to try to reach my sister, but I wasn't sure how to do it. And I had recently read this little book on hell called The Dogma of Hell, and it's a shocking, bracing, biblical account of hell, and from the lives of the saints and apparitions from souls that have come from hell by God's permission. So it had a profound effect on me, and I thought, well, I'd like to give it to her so that she will you know, maybe think about what she's doing. But I couldn't think of any easy way to give her a book on hell. So so that Christmas, I got 15 copies of this book, and I gave all my brothers and sisters and my parents and everybody this book on hell. And we were so Nancy and I and our kids, after our Christmas presents were opened that morning, we went to my parents' house. And so we're there at my parents' house. So there's some aunts and uncles and all the Madrid siblings. And I said, hey, everybody, I would just like it if you would all open the gift for me all at once. So they're like, oh, great. Yes, this is like cheerful wrapping paper and all that. They open it up, and it's a book on hell. And there's a picture of the devil on the front of it. And ho, ho, ho. So So what I found out was that my sister, she was the only one it was intended for. And some months later, she told me, she took me aside at some family event, and she said, you know, I knew that it was me you were giving me the book for. And I was really irked by that, she said. I was really irritated. But she said, I thought I would read the book. And she did read the book. She had a profound reconversion. And she traces it back to reading that book. So I just took a chance. You know, it's like throwing a dart. I don't know if it's going to work, but what have I got to lose? So I gave her this book. It had its desired effect. Okay, so now let's fast forward years to when this young woman is calling the show. She says, my brother's been bugging me to, you know, listen to your program, and I didn't want to do it. Finally, I thought, okay, I'll get him off my back. I'll turn it on, and I'll listen to it long enough that I could tell him I listened to it. She tunes in. What am I talking about? The story about my sister and this book on hell. She hears this story, and she broke down crying, because she's telling me the story now on the air. She broke down crying. She said, I ordered it on Amazon. It came like the next day. She said, I read the book. I had a profound reconversion. She said, I gave up that former way of life. I stopped all the shenanigans. I came back to the sacraments. I'm going to Mass every Sunday now. I've made a good confession. My parents are overjoyed. And she said, it's all because my brother was bugging me to listen to this program. Now, what are the odds that that's a mere coincidence? I don't think so. I think that's a miracle. It's a kind of mini miracle. And if there were time, I could regale you with countless examples of this, not because, you know, I'm anything special, but because I've been around long enough and I've been paying attention enough to see these miracles happening all the time. It's just phenomenal. So in your search and rescue efforts, recommend Catholic Radio, recommend books, give things away. Catholic Answers has many tracts that are very cheap. You can buy for pennies on the dollar and just have a supply and give them away. This book, I had a lady come up to me. I was at a parish seminar. She came up to me, and with tears in her eyes, she held this book up to me, and she says, this book brought me back to the Catholic Church. And I said, what happened? Because I'm a student. I love stories like this. So she said, it was a very similar story. She said that when she got out of high school, she was living a, you know, wild kind of promiscuous lifestyle. She completely checked out of the faith, and she was not practicing her faith at all. And so she said one day, and she had been away from the church for probably, by this time, 15, 20 years. And she said one day she was on a camping trip or a hiking trip. She was somewhere in rural Minnesota, the middle of nowhere. And she went into a one-room post office in the middle of nowhere, Minnesota, to buy stamps to mail postcards. So she's tearing up as she's telling me this story. And she says she went into this one-room post office to buy some stamps. Now, I don't know about you, but when you go to the post office, do your religious beliefs typically come up in conversation when you're talking to the post guy? Probably not. And I don't know what happened, but she said in this conversation, somehow it came up that she was an ex-Catholic. And the guy said, oh, you're an ex-Catholic. So he reaches under the counter and he pulls out a copy of this book. He says, you need to read this book. And she said, thank you, but no, I mean, I don't want to take your book. It's very thoughtful of you. He says, no, I've got a whole stack of these under the counter. And I give them to people just like you all the time. So she's like dazed. So she takes this book. She doesn't know what to make of it. And she's been away from the faith for 20 years. So she tells me the story. She goes back to her hotel room or wherever she was. She starts leafing through the book. She starts reading the stories. She has a profound conversion. She goes into the nearest town, goes to confession for the first time in 20 years. I got an email from a guy who was at a law school, a Protestant law school, Regent University. And he said he was like the only Catholic he knew, and all the Protestant people there were trying to get him to become Protestant. And he said he was really having a hard time until he ran across the book Surprised by Truth. And he wrote me an email just out of the blue, and he just said, hey, just want to thank you for the book. Somebody gave it to him. One of his Catholic friends gave him this book. He said, just want to say thanks for writing the book. That's all it was. And so I wrote him back, and I said, well, thank you for your nice note. And then just in the moment, I just had this idea. I don't know where it came from. I think I have a good idea where it came from now. But at the time, I didn't know where it came from. But my idea was, I wrote it back to him. I said, if I send you a case of this book at no charge, I'll even pay the UPS shipping, all I would ask is, would you be willing to distribute it to the people who are giving you the hardest time at this Protestant law school? And he wrote back and he said, sure, you know, what the heck. So I had a case of the book. It was 44 copies. I shoot it off to him. And I really and truly don't remember if I ever heard back from him after that. He might have said thank you, but I really don't remember. And so years and years and years went by, maybe 15 years went by, and I forgot about it. And I was at another event, and another woman, different woman, came up to me, and she said, that book brought me into the Catholic Church. And I said, what happened? She said, well, I was at law school at Regent University, and there was this Catholic guy. And we were always just jamming on this guy to try to get him to leave the Catholic Church until one day he walks in with his box of books on his shoulders and he starts giving away all these books. And she said, I got a copy, and I thought, what is this? People becoming Catholic, why would anyone do that? So she said she read the book. By now you know how this thing turns out. Profound conversion. She winds up becoming Catholic. So I told that story for the next several years, and everybody had the same reaction, like, oh my gosh, that's amazing.
We're having to make some cuts to the evening programming in order to create the hour program. There were several conversions that came from the same box of books, including a priest whom Patrick met at a Steubenville conference. Now to an argument of where is that in the Bible?
It's something that arose during the time of Martin Luther. It became an idea that was associated largely with the movement of Martin Luther and John Calvin, which is that everything that you must believe is found in the Bible, and don't believe things that are not found in the Bible. Well, obviously, if you're going to consider it from a logical standpoint, that has to be in the Bible in order for it to be a coherent thought. And it's not. And I encourage you, use this technique in your conversation with your Bible-only friends. You'll be surprised at how much of an effect it can have on them. You can also point out, you could say, well, you're saying I need to prove this from the Bible, but where does the Bible say I have to prove this from the Bible? Where does the Bible say I have to prove anything from the Bible? And the answer, of course, is nowhere. This is a presupposition that good, sincere people who love Jesus, I don't fault any of them, but they've grown up in that world where that's what they've been taught, and it actually is not anywhere found in the Bible. So a Catholic like you who knows even just a few little things like this, you can carry the conversation forward in a positive way. You can also point out, well, if you claim to go by the Bible alone, how do you know which books belong in the Bible? Because the Bible doesn't tell you. There's no inspired table of contents in the Bible that tells you these books belong in the Bible. The idea of the Bible alone, they actually have to appeal to a non-biblical tradition to say that they go by the Bible alone. Do you see how this works? It's fascinating. I was speaking at an event, I think it was in San Diego, and two Calvinist guys came up, a little bit kind of pugnacious. One of them was an ex-Catholic. He was the more anti-Catholic of the two. And at the end of my talk, they said, well, pretty much everything you said here tonight in your talk is wrong. And we would like to show you, would you be willing to sit down with us? We'll go get coffee, and we'd like to show you why you're wrong. And I live for this kind of thing. So I was like, yes, I'm so glad you asked. So we're sitting at Denny's. So I'm on my side of the booth. These two guys are on their side of the booth. They have their Bibles open. I have my Bible open. So the conversation starts with them saying, well, you Catholics, you add things to the Bible that aren't in there. You had your traditions, and I said, like what? So they gave me it. I think it was like Mary's perpetual virginity. So I opened my Bible, and I started quoting from the Bible. Then they changed from you're adding things to the Bible to you're misinterpreting that, or you're taking it out of context. That's what they then started saying. So when they said, you're taking that out of context, I said, no, I'm not. Well, yes, you are. I said, no, I'm not. You are. And they said, no, you are. And I said, no, you are. And it was, they'd never encountered that before, because Catholics generally start to backpedal, you know. And so I didn't do that, and they didn't know what to do with it. And so it was a rather frustrating hour or so of them trying to get me to see that my interpretations of the Bible were incorrect. And I was pointing out to them, well, how do you know that your interpretation of these passages might not be correct? And so it was sort of a stalemate. So after that unproductive hour or so, I took the napkin on the table, and with my pen, I wrote 6 words on this napkin. I said, "I never said you stole money." And then I turned the napkin in front of them, and I said, "Okay, do you understand the meaning of what I just wrote down?" And they read it. "Yeah, we understand it." And I said, for effect, I said, "Are you sure you understand what I mean by this? I never said you stole money." They said, "Yeah." I said, a third time, "Are you really sure you know what I mean by this?" And they said, "Yeah, what's your point?" I said, "Well, my point is, did I mean I never said you stole money, implying that somebody else said it? Or did I mean I never said you stole money? I thought it, but I never actually said it. Or did I mean I never said you stole money?" It's the guy sitting next to you. "Or did I mean I never said you stole money? Maybe you accidentally lit it on fire. I don't know. Or did I mean to say I never said you stole money?" So I asked them again, which of these 5 very different meanings did I intend by writing these 6 words down in your presence, in our common language? And they kind of sheepishly sort of shrugged and they said, "Okay, all right, I get your point. I guess we don't really know." So then for dramatic effect, I picked up my Bible and I said, "So you're telling me that you feel like you're guaranteed to know the authentic meaning of what's in these 73 books written by different authors to different audiences in different languages at different times and for different purposes, and you somehow are assured of knowing the correct meaning, and yet you can't tell me what I meant by 6 words on a napkin?" And it was at that point that I think we decided, well, we've had enough. And so that was the end of our conversation. Well, these things always seem to happen in intervals of 6 months. I don't know why, but about 6 months went by, and the former Catholic guy shows up at another event. And he came up to me and he said, "Hey, do you remember me?" I said, "Yeah, I remember you." He said, "Do you remember that napkin thing you did?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, I just want to shake your hand and say thank you, because that was the catalyst that started the ball rolling for me to say, you know, that's a good point. I wonder what the early Christians thought these verses meant." So he started reading the early church fathers, and he said that's all she wrote. He said he came back hard to the Catholic Church because he realized that the Catholic Church, or that the early church, was Catholic. So, I mean, anyone in this room can write 6 words on a napkin. So don't feel as though it's beyond your abilities to reach out to people in the more creative ways, sometimes the better. And I'll leave you with this last thought. And this has to do with, in your search and rescue efforts, to remember to rely on God, not yourself. So as you've seen from some of these things that I've done, including some of my failures, it was really in the midst of my doing kind of whatever I could think of in the moment. It wasn't all well thought out. It wasn't an intricate, elaborate argument. Usually these things tend to be very simple. And there was no sale that day because I was trying to do it all myself. And the lesson I learned, especially since, as far as I know, Bob is still a Southern Baptist, no thanks to me, but the lesson I learned, I do believe the Holy Spirit wanted to knock me down several pegs. And he did so, and I've never forgotten it, because I was trying to do it all myself. And you and I are just like the sowers of the seed in the parable. God is the master of the harvest, not me, not you. But he uses us, he desires to use us to share the truth. And scattering seed is pretty easy. We can all do that. So the Bible says, "Speak, Lord, your servant is listening." What I was doing is saying, "Listen, Lord, your servant is speaking. Let me take care of this, and when I'm done, then you can step in." And I had it exactly backwards. So that's my final thought. As you go in search of these miracles, they're out there waiting to be had. As you speak the truth in love, as you share in your own way, according to your own temperament and your own background, don't be afraid to do it. Don't be afraid to be creative. Don't be afraid to give away books and CDs and tracts and things like that. But just remember that in the end, it's all God's doing, and he just wants us to participate. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you. Tonight's talk is based on the book, Search and Rescue. So if you'd like to go much deeper, this is a book that'll show you how to do it. Don't give this book to your non-Catholic friends, because then they'll know what you're up to. This book is for you. If you want to give a book to your non-Catholic friends, I would recommend The Surprised by Truth 2 that I talked about, Conversion Testimonies.
Get Patrick's books at patrickmadrid.com.